We're going to begin today a study of the fifth, the final book of Torah, the book of Deuteronomy. Man, we've come a long way, haven't we? To this point in Torah, we have seen the creation of the world and of mankind, the destruction of the world and all but eight humans, and that by a great flood, and then the earth's very rapid repopulation. We've seen the creation of a people set apart for God because the world after the flood again quickly became wicked and it turned away from him. This automatically means the world became divided into two distinct groups, God's people and everybody else. God's people are called Hebrews. Everybody else is called Gentiles. The Hebrews were not chosen for any kind of special merit on their part, nor were they chosen because they were a mighty people. They weren't. The reason they were chosen isn't even precisely stated in the Bible. In later times, God says he chose Israel because of his love for the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, though this is a very broad and unspecific cause of his selection. The Lord has now issued two major covenants, both of them to Israel. The first covenant was to Abraham, that out of him would come the Hebrew people, later called Israel, and that they would receive a special allotment of land for their own. And the second covenant on Mount Sinai, the law, was issued through Moses to a nation of people called Israel. This second covenant set down exactly how Israel was to live, this redeemed life that God intended. So, it consisted of civil and religious and moral ordinances and rules. These laws were to be obeyed explicitly, fully, without question. Yet these laws were also an ideal. They were an ideal that reflected the purity and the pattern of heaven itself. And Israel was never able to follow these laws and their principles and patterns to any reasonable degree. Israel, as Deuteronomy begins, is to this point a people without a country. They were formed and they grew into a nation in the belly of the beast, Egypt. God has rescued them from that beast. He's redeemed them. And now, after their redemption, he has given them his laws, his commandments, so that they can know God's character. They can know what pleases him, what displeases him. By obeying these laws and observing these special holy occasions, harmony with God can be achieved. Disobedience and disregard for those laws brought down God's wrath upon their heads. Yahweh also established an elite set-apart group of people from among the overall set-apart people. This group is the tribe of Levi, who are his priests and his servants and guardians of the Lord's holiness on earth. At this moment, Israel, all 3 million of them, is standing on the eastern edge of the Jordan River in Moab, not far from Jericho. And Moses is about to address them in a stirring speech. It's this address that forms the basis for the book of Deuteronomy. Now, I congratulate you for hanging in there, especially those that started at the beginning with us in Genesis, because it's been over 3 years getting to this point in Torah. The bad news is that we'll finish our fourth year before we complete Deuteronomy. And then kind of graduate from the Torah into the next several books of the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh. The good news is that unlike what many of you might have heard, maybe assumed, Deuteronomy is not at all a repeat of the first four books of Torah. It's not even a summary. So what can we expect from Deuteronomy? Well, first, let's take a look at the name Deuteronomy itself. Deuteronomy comes from the Greek. Deuteronomion Tuto, which means the second law. And as I've stated on numerous occasions, that translating the original Hebrew into another language, Greek in this case, and then from Greek to yet another language, Latin, and then from Latin into English, all this is fraught with problems, as you can imagine. And I pointed up a few of those problems during our time together. Now, we are not only dealing with differing languages, we're dealing with differing cultures. So what a word indicated in one language and culture didn't always have a direct counterpart in another language and culture. This has led to hundreds of Bible versions in existence today, each of which has its advantages and its disadvantages for the serious Bible student. The title of this fifth book of the Bible, that we know it as Deuteronomy, is a victim of these language and cultural variations. Hebrews did not name the books of the Bible. Rather, they just spoke of them by using the first several words that began each book. The first words of our new undertaking are, "These are the words." So, the Hebrews called this book Elei HaDevarim. Elei HaDevarim, which is, "These are the words," in Hebrew. The current popular name in Hebrew is Sefer Devarim, the book of "These are the words." And even that is usually shortened to simply Devarim. The title Deuteronomy actually comes from an error in understanding the meaning of chapter 17, verse 18 of Deuteronomy that says, "This is a copy of the teaching of Moses." The Greek Deuteronomion doesn't mean copy. It means second, as in another one. So while the Hebrew intends copy, the Greek intends second, another one. But the purpose of the book is not a second set of laws, a kind of second Torah, if you would. It's just a copy of what Moses taught earlier, adjusted for the difference in circumstance between wandering around out in the wilderness as Bedouins and living in a settled life in Canaan, which is about what they were to do. All that said, for the sake of communication in our native language of English, I shall use the word Deuteronomy, because it's the one we're all familiar with. Now, the oldest extant text of Deuteronomy goes back to the 9th century and is called the Masoretic text, which includes the entire Hebrew Bible. However, the discovery and the translation of the Dead Sea Scrolls that date to before Christ contains many large fragments, not all, but a lot of fragments of Deuteronomy, and examination has proved them to be nearly identical with the Masoretic text, except for some minor spelling or copyist errors or maybe minor grammar differences. So what we have available to us today is accurate to at least 100 to 200 BC. Now, many modern scholars have an affinity for trying to disprove the authenticity of the five books of Moses, and most of the Bible for that matter. The primary method they use for this is called literary criticism. Another is called textual criticism. The idea in general is to examine the ancient texts to determine if what was written down makes sense for the era it claims to have been written. And they look for signs that perhaps more than one style of writing was incorporated, which indicates to them that multiple writers were involved. And even if what was said is in their eyes appropriate for what is archaeologically known about that era. So Deuteronomy is now said to have been written in the 8th century BC, not the 14th or 13th. Century BC, which is probably when Moses was leading Israel out of Egypt. Let me assure you, however, there's no need to buy into the latest so-called scientific findings that more closely approximates a fad. First, it's anything but scientific. There's no tests. There's no standards by which to measure whether or not these folks are right. This is about speculation that revolves around their subjective worldview. This is not unlike the recent spate of Hollywood movies about cavemen and how dinosaurs must have lived and operated in a primitive earthly environment. The same scholars who refuse to acknowledge the accuracy of the ancient Hebrew documents that we call the Bible, because for them, there are not sufficient written documents of other societies from that era to verify the veracity of the content of the same ones who find that animal or human skeletal remains, some faded cave paintings, some spearheads, and some scattered artifacts. They have no problem with making full-length feature films showing hairy men grunting at one another, fighting over equally hairy women, by the way. All the while munching away on a raw mammoth rib. This is no problem for them. And of course, there must always be the enormous and now extinct reptiles running around in packs and interacting with each other, even intelligently communicating, if you believe Jurassic Park. And as far as I know, none of these creatures, hairy humans, or gigantic lizard reptiles have left us any written documents. But these scientists just don't have a problem insisting that their version of the ancient past, with but the scantest of real evidence, that's the correct one. While it's very likely that redactions to all the books of the Torah have occurred to some degree over the centuries, the reality is that every fragment of Torah ever found from any era closely matches with one another. The evidence is that Deuteronomy was partially penned by Moses, or probably his scribe, as well as some other contributors. And this is because part of the book of Deuteronomy takes place after Moses' death. Could some of redaction have taken place in the 8th century BC, the time at which some scholars say Deuteronomy was actually first created? Certainly. Likely. However, to say that the main body of this book was first written 500 years after the Exodus is nothing but a blatant form of modern secular or liberal Judeo-Christian intellectualism that seeks to harmonize the Bible with whatever is currently politically correct or popular among academic colleagues. In fact, in earliest Christianity, there was no concept of anything but a Torah written by Moses. Even in the far older religion of Judaism, there was no serious thought or dissent from the common knowledge that the Torah had been written by Moses. We find the likes of Philo and Josephus, for instance, insisting on a Moses-authored Torah. In the end, it wasn't until the late 17th and then early 18th centuries in Europe, during the period of the Enlightenment, that's when secular humanism was invented, and the first scholarly objections to the Torah suddenly arose. I mean, it's hard for me to put the arrogance and the irrationality of this line of thinking into severe enough terms. Academics from 3,000 years after the fact want to argue with the writings of historians who were present, or at least 2,000 years closer to the actual events as they unfolded, and tell them that what they saw, they never saw. Oh, you guys from 3,000 years ago, you got it all wrong. What they lived through, they didn't perceive correctly. I mean, I just reject all that. See, Deuteronomy is going to be a surprising book to most of you. It's going to surprise primarily in the concepts it so beautifully and articulately presents about God, about the land of Canaan, about the law, and several other important subjects. In fact, I submit to you that Deuteronomy is the Moses version of Yeshua's Sermon on the Mount. And here's why. Moses begins this book by recounting how it is that Israel got to where they are at this moment. And in doing so, he expounds on at least 50% of the laws that were given at Mount Sinai. In other words, he goes through almost all of the law, point by point, and he tells Israel what it is that they are to conclude is God's purpose for this law, for this law, for this law. And we're going to find that Moses takes the law from its purely physical, mechanical level to a higher spiritual level of godly principles that governs all things, anywhere, during any era. He'll explain why certain rituals were laid down the way they were, what their spiritual purpose is, what the God principles are behind them, and therefore why they're important, why they need to be obeyed. Therefore, we'll have Moses saying that this is the law that was enacted back at Mount Sinai 40 years earlier, and this is the way that this first generation of the Exodus has practiced it up to now. However, I'm going to tell you how we should understand it, and then how we ought to execute God's instructions when we get settled in Canaan. And of course, in the New Testament counterpart of Moses' speech, we have Yeshua in the book of Matthew doing essentially the same thing. Moses took the law from the primary physical behavioral to a more spiritual plane in Deuteronomy. And in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus takes the spiritual element that Moses gave to the law in Deuteronomy, much of it, by the way, had been lost by that time, and he moves it to a yet higher and purer level. Jesus says, and I paraphrase, "Here is historically how your ancestors thought of this command of God, how the traditions of men have affected it. I'm going to tell you what it actually means and how it's intended in heaven." We have the first mediator of God, Moses, expounding on the ideal of the law in Deuteronomy. We have the second and best mediator of God, Yeshua, expounding on the ideal of the law in the book of Matthew. And the reason and the conditions for this first expounding of the law in the Bible by Moses was this coming death, and then the subsequent entry of God's people into the promised land of Canaan, God's earthly kingdom. The reason and conditions for the second expounding of the law in the Bible, which is by Yeshua, was his coming death and the subsequent entry of God's people into God's kingdom, but it's a spiritual kingdom. Now, I hope this makes sense to you for a number of reasons. First, if you can understand the parallel that I just drew for you, you're going to have a good basic context for understanding Deuteronomy. Second, this is just further dramatic proof of God's established patterns. Patterns that begin in Genesis, they go right on through the Bible, and they don't ever end. They repeat over, over again. But as we move through the Bible, we see these patterns that kind of began as mere dust and clay. They felt very physical. And then they progressively move into a higher and a higher spiritual plane until at the end of the Bible, all the laws and patterns established by Yehovah are at the absolute ultimate spiritual perfection and essence that God has planned and ordained for his creation, because essentially there is going to come a time when the lines between heaven and earth start to blur. And eventually they merge into one. And third, it helps to establish that the newness of the so-called New Testament or New Covenant is not about a new set of principles, not even additional ones, or that some principles or laws are abolished and they're replaced by new ones. Rather, the newness is that the Old Testament Messiah has come. He is Yeshua of Nazareth. All that was promised has come with him. Or in some cases, the process has been advanced towards the ultimate world to come. In other words, this constant drumbeat we have always heard in the church about love and grace and peace and mercy and redemption as being a new revelation that is at the core of a New Testament system is simply not so. It was first introduced in the Torah. Much of it we're going to see right here in Deuteronomy. Now let me comment about another aspect of this Sermon on the Mount parallel with Moses' address in Moab to the people of Israel. Actually, it was a series of three addresses that we'll see in Deuteronomy. This was more a sermon than a re-rendering of the code of laws given as an oracle from God on Mount Sinai. This is why the Sermon on the Mount is called a sermon, not an oracle. It was Jesus preaching, teaching on the law. It was not an oracle that created a second law or a new law. It was the same on the mountains in Moab with Moses as the orator. He was preaching about the law. He wasn't making new laws or abolishing old ones. So what we're going to study in Deuteronomy will help to set the context, not just for the books that immediately follow it, like Joshua and Judges, but for the New Testament as well. Perhaps one of the most difficult things for a Christian who has come to understand the era of restoration that we've entered and the reality that Israel is in process of having the torch of the gospel handed back to them by the Gentiles who took the lead of evangelizing for about 1900 years is how to approach that section of the Bible that has been relegated to the trash bin for so long, the Old Testament. We who speak fondly of the Hebrew roots of our faith, we've struggled right along with the rest of our brothers and sisters in Christ who form the larger and more mainstream portion of the church about just how are we to deal with this very ancient code of laws that we find in the Torah. I mean, how does a modern Christian keep Torah? I mean, are we to avoid wearing clothes of mixed cloth? Are we to reestablish a society where males decide everything? I vote for that. kidding. Is my wife out here somewhere? Okay. Should we reestablish cities of refuge for people who accidentally kill? Are we to celebrate the biblical festivals and observe the Jewish Sabbath? Men, are we to adopt rabbinical Jewish traditions like wearing kippahs, sporting full beards, reading from Jewish prayer books? Should we insist that we sit apart from our wives during congregational services? Women, should you see yourselves as unclean during your period? Should you remove yourself from your husband during that time and immerse in a mikvah at the end of your cycle? You see, the thing is that Moses in Deuteronomy draws attention to the fact that the issue he is addressing in Moab is not whether these laws and principles still exist, but rather, how do you apply them? How do you reapply them in evolving societal conditions and in various locations? How do we do that? Yeshua did essentially the same thing, but he was more concerned in his sermon with something that Moses didn't have to contend with. Moses didn't have to tell the people that the law would continue because he was addressing the people of the law. And any thought that the law would be terminated was unthinkable. But 1,300 years later, on a hill overlooking the Galilee, Yeshua was speaking to a crowd of Jews and some Gentiles, and he needed to make it crystal clear that nothing he said should be construed as abolishing even the slightest sliver of the law, nor was he changing the pronouncements of the prophets. Indeed, he said, not until heaven and earth passes away could such a thing be contemplated. And of course, we find that discourse in Matthew 5. So please pay very close attention to Deuteronomy, because we're going to see how a society has evolved after only four decades. And thus there was a practical need for change in the details of observing the law to account for these new conditions. And we're in the same boat today. Deuteronomy, like all other books of the Bible, wasn't written in a vacuum. It's not a standalone book. Deuteronomy, just like the New Testament, will be misunderstood and it will be misapplied if we don't read and understand what came before it as a foundation. Deuteronomy assumes, as Moses assumes, that many of the things that are going to be discussed have been known. It's already been assimilated into the Hebrews' everyday life for quite some time. So Moses is not going to define his terms because those terms were common knowledge. He won't fully repeat a law as given in Exodus or Leviticus or Numbers when he wants to preach about it. Instead, he'll just often refer to a certain law or a command in an abbreviated form because it's already understood. Moses will draw on incidents like the golden calf, the Balaam and Balak affair. He'll even speak about what happened to Miriam. And what happened to Miriam was so infamous and ingrained in these people that he wasn't going to explain the obvious, that she was punished with a skin disease for a rebellion, and she was exiled from the camp for a while until her disease ended. Deuteronomy had an enormous effect on the developments of Jewish tradition that would come far into the future. But even before that, the prophets who brought God's oracles to Israel on his behalf would use the verbiage and the imagery that Moses used in this matchless book. Almost 200 of the original 613 Torah commandments come in Deuteronomy. The method that Moses expounded on the law is closer to how rabbis, at least at first, commented on the law. And so rabbinical halakha, rabbinical legal rulings, have a form and a protocol much more similar to how things are written and presented in Deuteronomy than in the four earlier books of Torah. Deuteronomy forms an important part of ancient and modern day Jewish liturgy. For instance, the Shema, the Hear, O Israel, Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9. It holds a premium spot in Jewish synagogue service. Other phrases from Deuteronomy are interspersed in standard Jewish prayers, such as the Amidah on the Aleinu. In order to best prepare you for this tremendous book, I would like to lay some groundwork on the main premises that are going to be discussed so that you can kind of be looking for them as they come along. J.H. Tige, a noted Hebrew scholar, has done a masterful job of assessing the primary themes that form Deuteronomy. And since it would be hard, if not impossible, for me to improve upon that, I'm just going to lay it out like he sees it. At the top of the list is that the highest and most fundamental principle that undergirds Deuteronomy is monotheism. Now, while to modern Christians and Jews, that doesn't seem like such an earth-shattering revelation, the principle of there being but one God was almost incomprehensible to the mind of the Hebrew and Gentile of that era. All throughout our years of studying together, I've tried to point out the inescapable reality that when the Old Testament says things like gods, plural, or God of gods and Lord of lords, this was simply reflecting what every human culture believed, that there were many gods. And each nation had its own gods who presided over some particular territory. And further, while Israel believed in one God, it's not that they believed that there was a sum total of one God in existence. It's that in their peculiar case, their God only permitted them to have one God. Him. He tolerated no competition. And as a result, to the Hebrews' mind, and to all those people who surrounded the Hebrews, Israel was God poor. Having only one God was downright embarrassing. And I have also tried to point out that through the first four-fifths of the Torah, we really don't find Yahweh, or Moses, or anybody else for that matter, pushing very hard on the idea that it's not that Israel is allowed only one God, it's that there's only one God in existence, and he's the God of everything and everyone. Well, that subject is addressed here in Deuteronomy. And here in Deuteronomy, Moses makes it clear there is but one God, period. And it is a concept that is not very well received by the Israelites. It's not taken very seriously, because we're going to see the people of Israel just move from apostasy to apostasy to apostasy, worshiping God after God after God, and suffering dearly for it. The next major thing that we'll find in Deuteronomy is loyalty to God. Loyalty goes hand in hand with the monotheistic stream of thought. The logic is that if there is only one God, and this God has decided to bless Israel above all people on the earth, then the obvious response ought to be loyalty to him. In fact, Israel is not only not to revert to worshiping other gods or things like the stars and the moon and the comets, they're to destroy the temples and the altars and the high places of all of these non-gods throughout the land of Canaan. Then we find that Moses discusses the entire concept of God. A man who'd been a Christian for at least 50 years told me that until he studied Torah with us, he didn't realize that until then he really didn't know who God was. I agree with him totally on that. It's in the Torah, and primarily Deuteronomy, that we get a very majestic and succinct picture of God's attributes, such that we can understand who he is much more in depth than we can understand him from only studying the New Testament. For instance, God's nearness is much further refined. God lives in heaven, but it's his presence that dwells with Israel. It was not God who was in the fire on the summit of Mount Sinai. Rather, it was the Lord's kavod, his glory that was there. The Lord hasn't moved from heaven into a tent sanctuary called the Wilderness Tabernacle, but his Shekhinah, right, his Shekinah, is there hovering above the Ark of the Covenant. In other words, as I spoke of earlier, Moses takes the typical physical nature of the world of false gods who are present completely or partially on earth, usually in the forms of animals or a pharaoh or a king or a river, and he makes it obsolete. Rather, Moses invokes the spirituality and the formlessness of God as his true essence. Yet, Yahweh is a God with something akin to emotions. He is a God who loves and gets angry and gets jealous. He's not some distant being that sets the world into motion, gives mankind rules for living, and then takes a long vacation with a do not disturb sign hanging on his door. This is a God that craves intimacy with people who love him. Next, the theme of the covenant relationship between God and Israel is affirmed. The first two covenants are reviewed and they're discussed. And in chapter 26, Moses will emphasize that even though the covenant relationship has its foundation both legal and religious elements, that the relationship between God and Israel goes well beyond emotional and spiritual, or rather spiritualized, ties. Rather, Israel has specific, definable obligations to meet. Meeting these obligations reflects both a proper attitude and it demonstrates Israel's intent to be obedient to the way the Lord has ordained many of these obligations to be performed. And then this is part and parcel of this covenant relationship. There's a lot the modern church can learn from all this. This covenant theme goes to some length to make it clear that that physical action must accompany spiritual faith. You can't compartmentalize it. To try and separate these two things is folly. In other words, works are an indispensable part of a believer's walk with God. Some places in the church today, works is practically a four-letter word. Everything has been spiritualized to the point that what we do is secondary to what we feel. That once we've accepted Christ as our Savior, we have no further obligations to the Father. Everything becomes optional for us. The New Testament book of James addresses this head on. James 2:26 says, "For just as the body without the spirit is dead, faith without works is dead." But this was not a new idea. Works coupled with faith was standard within Judaism because the concept of it is found in the Torah and Moses expounds upon it in Deuteronomy. Now, it's going to take some of you by surprise, I think, that another major theme of Deuteronomy is love. The love that is discussed is primarily about God's love towards Israel and to a lesser degree to all mankind. The bond of love is to be reflected in God's people, not only towards God, but towards one another and even towards foreigners. Who Israel is, and God's eyes is also central to Deuteronomy. Israel is a nation whose God and king is Yahweh. Israel is as a son to God because he created them. He redeemed them. He guided them through the wilderness. He says he'll fight for them. He'll protect them and has chosen Israel from among all nations on earth for a special, one-of-a-kind relationship with him. Other themes that will be discussed at some length in Deuteronomy are the land that is now Israel, the law, and the need to stay safely within the boundaries of behavior and thought that the Lord has ordained for Israel. One of the most interesting themes that we'll uncover is the process of centralizing the place of sacrificial worship. That is, once Israel is in possession of the promised land, there's going to be one common place where everyone is to bring their sacrifices. There'll be only one authorized place of atonement, nowhere else. And it is so, as is so central to both Judaism and Christianity today, the theme of humanitarianism is focused upon in Deuteronomy. Orphans, widows, the poor, the sick, slaves, foreigners living among Israel, even animals, captured soldiers. These are all given attention as Israel is exhorted to be humane in all their dealings with God's creatures. So despite a terribly faulty rhetoric that has been the mainstay of too much church doctrine for centuries, that in the Old Testament, what we see is an angry God, a vengeful God, a legalistic God, a bloodthirsty God. But in the New, we see a peaceful God, merciful, self-sacrificing, the God of grace and shalom. This notion is completely destroyed, not only when we study the first four books of the Torah, but especially when we study Deuteronomy. And we'll start that study next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.